This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
With global record heat this year, plus fires and dangerous floods, climate change and greenhouse gases have the spotlight. But there's another way humans change the air and the weather. Every hour of every day, smokestacks, cars, and homes pump tiny particles into the sky. They are bits of chemicals, metals, plastics, and organic materials, all floating in the air, traveling on the winds until the rain brings them back down. These are the aerosols, and top scientists like James Hansen warns ignoring them is dangerous. We have new science on aerosol pollution. The open access paper is titled, "Rapidly Evolving Aerosol Emissions Are a Dangerous Omission from Near-Term Climate Risk Assessments." Could pollution-driven weather changes be as important for some of you as greenhouse gas emissions? The lead author is Dr. Geeta Persad, Assistant Professor of Climate Science at the University of Texas, Austin. She leads the Persad Aeroclimate Group there. From Austin, Geeta Persad, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me.
So a 2021 study by scientists from Harvard in the UK found at least 8 million people died prematurely in 2018 due to emissions from fossil fuels alone. What sort of aerosols come from our heavy car culture and truck transportation?
That's a great point. So many of the same things in our society that produce the greenhouse gases that are bad for climate change also produce these aerosol particles that are really bad for air pollution and for health. So, for example, sometimes you may hear the phrase PM2.5 talked about in terms of air quality, and that means particulate matter that's smaller than 2.5 microns in diameter, so smaller than the size of a human hair. And so those particles can get into our lungs, enter our bloodstream, affect heart health, affect cardiovascular health. And some of the components of that include things like black carbon or soot, which is basically the black stuff that you see coming out of the tailpipe of a vehicle that isn't up to standard. Many of the emissions from wildfire smoke fall into that category. Many of the emissions from industrial activities, so things that produce sulfur dioxide, the production of cement, the production of bricks, this is a big source of these emissions, especially in the developing world. So many of these same activities that we worry about in terms of greenhouse gases are also really problematic in terms of air pollution and aerosols.
So reading your paper, it comes out that the word smog or pollution hides as much as it explains. In reality, there are many, many different kinds of pollution, and these have been changing over time as industry and agriculture have changed. Geeta, can we even compare air pollution, say, in 1970 to what's up there today?
So we actually know a fair amount about how these air pollutants have changed through time. And actually, one of the biggest drivers of the changes in these pollutants has been the desire for better air quality. So we can actually map how the geographic distribution of these pollutants has changed from, say, 1970 to today. And you can actually see the signal, for example, of clean air regulations in the U.S. and in Europe that actually cause a really noticeable reduction in these air pollutants in the mid, 1960s and 1970s, where places like China and India in the period since then have really increased their emissions of these pollutants as they've industrialized. And so we can actually track and map the spatial evolution of these aerosol emissions that has largely come from evolution and trends in air quality regulation, trends in globalization, and trends in industrialization across the world.
Some aerosols cool while others warm. Please explain, is the cooling or the warming dominant?
This is a great question and actually one of the most important, and I would argue as a scientist, interesting things about aerosols. So there are two big differences between how greenhouse gases impact the climate system and how aerosols impact the climate system. The first difference is that greenhouse gases impact the climate system by trapping the heat radiation coming off of Earth's surface, whereas these aerosol particles impact the climate system by interacting with sunlight and also helping with the formation of clouds that interact with sunlight. So when we talk about the types of aerosols that cool the planet, we're talking about the types of aerosol particles that scatter or reflect sunlight. And so you can imagine, even if you pick up a handful of sand on the beach, you might notice that there are some grains that look really white and other grains that look really dark. The same is true of the pollution that ends up in the atmosphere. Some of it is really bright and reflective, and some of it is really dark, which means that it's absorbing sunlight. So when we talk about the types of air pollutants, the types of aerosols that warm the climate system, we're talking about those types of pollution that is dark and essentially absorb sunlight. And so you can get more different types of industrial activity produce more of the scattering types of aerosols, and other types produce more of the warming or absorbing types of aerosols. So, for example, diesel vehicles produce a lot of the warming type of aerosol, which is what we typically refer to as black carbon. Now, when we look at all of the sources of aerosol, of sort of human activities that produce aerosols globally, on average, the cooling component of the aerosols dominates the warming component of the aerosols. But if you look in particular regions, there can actually be a fairly strong balance between the cooling aerosols and the warming aerosols. And that in and of itself can actually have some really important impacts on regional climate that are very distinct from greenhouse gases. Because the other big difference between greenhouse gases and aerosols is that aerosols are very short-lived in the atmosphere. They only last for weeks to months compared to greenhouse gases that can last for hundreds of years. And so what that means is that aerosols don't actually have enough time to get far from where they're emitted. And so as a result, the aerosols actually stay very concentrated near where those pollution sources are. And so some of the climate signals, not all of them, but some of the climate signals from aerosols also stay concentrated near the pollution sources. So the aerosols have a very different sort of geographic fingerprint of climate impact.
Well, a little later, I want to talk to you about some of the possible distant connections, called teleconnections. But first, I want to get to this. For over a decade, a former NASA scientist James Hansen warned there is more global warming in the pipeline. If true, we would get even hotter, even if all the fossil fuel burning stopped today. So Hansen attributed some of the committed warming to the cooling effect of aerosol pollution. Do we know how much heating, how much hotter it would get, maybe even in a percentage of a degree of global mean temperature, if we clean up the air pollution?
So a number that I can give you is if you look over the industrial era and you look at all of the warming that has come from increasing greenhouse gases over the industrial era, the aerosols that have been increasing over that same time period have offset between 30 and 50% of that warming over the entire industrial era. So if you think about the fact that we've warmed about a degree Celsius over the industrial period, if we hadn't had the aerosols increasing over that same period, we might have been 0.3 to a half a degree warmer. And so when we think about things like the really ambitious Paris Agreement target of keeping warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, the aerosol signal has almost been the difference over the industrial era between whether or not we've already crossed that threshold.
If we just talk about smog and heat, we're missing one of the big stories of climate change. Most of the dialogue about global warming has been about heat rather than extreme rainfall and flood events, which have been striking all over the world this September. Tell us how aerosol pollution can change the way rain falls.
Aerosol pollution can change rainfall through a huge range of pathways. Maybe the easiest one to think about is just in the fact that it's offsetting global warming. And so that's just the very basic idea that we have, that as the global temperatures increase, precipitation may get more intense. And so if you're reducing that global warming, then you're potentially offsetting some of that increase. But the aerosol signal is much more subtle than that. So when we start looking regionally, because aerosols, they have this very patchy spatial distribution, they're also impacting the climate system in a very patchy way spatially. And the big influence that that has is it actually changes regional circulation patterns. And if you think about what actually drives rainfall in some of the most rainfall-sensitive parts of the world, so for example, in South Asia, where huge populations rely on monsoon circulation for food security and for their livelihood, the ability of aerosols to impact the regional circulation in those areas is actually a much more important driver of how rainfall has changed there. So there's actually been a range of studies that show that reductions in monsoon rainfall that we saw over the second half of the 20th century were mostly driven by increases in aerosol pollution, both in South Asia, but also across the Northern Hemisphere. And so aerosols can also impact these precipitation patterns through changing these sort of weather patterns that drive rainfall in different parts of the world. And then the third way that aerosols can impact rainfall is actually through the way that they interact with clouds. So we haven't talked very much yet about the fact that these aerosol particles are actually a critical part of why we have clouds on planet Earth. So a cloud is basically just water vapor that's condensed. And in order for that water vapor to condense and form a cloud droplet, you actually need some nucleus for it to condense onto. And these aerosol particles are really efficient nuclei for these cloud droplets. And so what we actually see is that as our atmosphere gets more polluted with aerosol pollution, our clouds can actually get thicker, which means that they have lots of tiny droplets because they have so many of these nuclei available to form cloud droplets on. But what that means is that each of those droplets is really tiny, and what you need for rainfall is a droplet big enough to fall out of your cloud. And so there's an emerging area of research showing that the increase of aerosols in some places can actually suppress rainfall by making it harder for a cloud to rain.
I just want to make this clear. Does the amount of air pollution directly affect weather for people living below it? For example, the air of Mumbai has been clouded with pollution during recent years. If the government acts to clean that up, would that change weather over Mumbai or over India, or does it change things everywhere?
So I think yes to all of them. So there have been studies that show, for example, that the presence of aerosols in a city can increase the likelihood of thunderstorms. And this gets into really complex processes in how aerosols do things like heat the atmosphere right before a rainstorm. But then you also get these sort of regional circulation effects that I've talked about. You are likely to also get situations where, say, if the air gets cleaned up in Mumbai, not only does that change weather directly over Mumbai, but it's likely to change the overall circulation in that area. And then if you're removing, say, cooling aerosols from Mumbai, you're also removing cooling aerosols from the entire climate system, which means that you are then also theoretically having an influence on the global energy balance that can be felt far afield from just the place where you're removing the aerosol.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
You're listening to Radio Ecoshock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Geeta Prasad from the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about air pollution, your health, and the weather. Now, when two states seem to occur together in time, even across great distances, science calls that teleconnection. And we may not know the mechanism of how it works, but the recurring pattern is there. So it's hard for us to understand how increasing aerosol pollution in Europe might cause drought in eastern China. Geeta, are we getting closer to knowing how these smog and distant weather connections work?
Yes. There's been a huge body of work over the last 10 to 15 years that have really connected the vast understanding we have of what controls the flow of energy and moisture in the atmosphere with this body of knowledge that we now have about the impact of aerosols on climate. And so there's been a lot of work now that shows that aerosols are capable of basically changing the standard patterns of circulation in the atmosphere, and that's the main pathways through which they create these teleconnections. So I'll give you just one example of that. One of the dominant patterns of atmospheric circulation is what we call the Hadley circulation, which is this pattern of circulation in the world's tropical regions. And this is characterized by lots of rising motion right near the equator, and that leads, for example, to the rainy season across the tropics. and then descending motion over the subtropical regions. And this is actually a big reason why our deserts happen to lie at around the same latitude bands across the world. If you've ever looked at a map, you might notice that, for example, the Sahara Desert is at roughly the same latitude as some of the deserts across North America. And that's not a coincidence. That's actually a result of this atmospheric circulation pattern. Now, one of the things that we know about this Hadley circulation, this tropical rising and subtropical sinking, is that it's very strongly controlled by how much energy each of Earth's hemispheres is getting. And one of the things that aerosols have done over the industrial era is that they've cooled the northern hemisphere more than the southern hemisphere. And that's because most of our industrial activity that's been producing these aerosols has been in the northern hemisphere, places like North America, places like Europe. And so that actually has pulled this tropical circulation pattern off of the equator. And it's that process that we think has led to some of the teleconnected signals that we've seen in response to, say, changes in European emissions. So, for example, during the 1980s, there was a major drought in the Sahel region of Africa that led to massive famine and huge loss of life. And this scientific understanding that has emerged over the last 10 or 15 years has allowed us to connect that reduction in rainfall over the Sahel to the increase in European aerosol emissions and the effect that that had on this tropical circulation pattern that's so important for precipitation in places like the Sahel.
Wow. So a non-industrial region, relatively, like Africa, could have people, they can't get enough rain for their rain-fed agricultural crops, so there's going to be starvation because of pollution, possibly in Europe, or you could have that in other parts of the world where industrial centers are changing things far away.
Yes, this is one of the points that we really try to emphasize in the paper. I think it's really easy for people to think that air pollution is only a problem for the places that are breathing it in. But through these climate pathways, we're really showing that the changes in this aerosol pollution are not only an issue for the places where those changes are happening, they can be a problem basically across the whole world.
In early 2020, ports closed and industrial production was greatly reduced in many countries due to the pandemic. What happened to aerosols then, and did that produce any expected changes?
Yes, so there were a range of studies that emerged after the COVID-19 crisis and all of the shutdowns that happened to try to capture the effect of that reduction in aerosol pollution for overall climate. The reality, though, that signal was pretty small in the grand scheme of things, and then our emissions and our activity picked right back up again. So it's a very short-lived impact on climate. However, it is important to note that aerosols obviously were not the only thing that changed during the COVID pandemic. There were changes in carbon dioxide emissions, changes in even the amount of airplane contrails because there was so much less air travel. And of all of the different changes in sort of our industrial activity that could have influenced climate during COVID, the aerosol signal was the largest. So even though the overall signal of the COVID pandemic on climate was fairly small, the aerosol signal was the most important part of that. And so when we think about maybe more sustained long-term changes in industrial activity that the COVID-19 pandemic might be an analog for, that's really demonstrating that this aerosol signal is a really important marker of industrial change that we know can have an influence on the climate system.
Well, and long-term planners and modelers, they generally work for big universities or institutions or governments. It's expensive stuff. They seldom include the possibility this economy could collapse. I mean, suppose civilization went into a prolonged industrial depression and aerosols drop rapidly, say within a couple of months. What would happen?
So this idea of how sort of the evolution of society is going to impact the evolution of aerosol pollution is a really fascinating area and one that I would argue we really don't understand well. And so if you actually look at the sort of socioeconomic models that are used to build sort of scenarios of how aerosol emissions might evolve, there's actually often an assumption that if societies are doing well, aerosol emissions will actually go down. And the reason for that is that as a country, say, gets richer, it has the ability to put more of its resources into doing things like cleaning up its air. And so it may be more willing to invest in technologies that may be more expensive, but that are cleaner. And so as a result, there's often this assumption that as we get richer, we will reduce our aerosols just because of those air quality benefits. So you could argue, actually, that in the scenario that you painted, where our economy collapses, you might actually see more aerosol emissions, because as our economy collapses, rather than eliminating industrial activities altogether, we might shift our mode of industrial activity to get rid of all of the more expensive things that we have done to clean up our air, just so that we can at least produce the things that we need to produce. There's an important open question about how these different trajectories of how different societies are going to evolve is going to affect human emissions of aerosols. And that's actually a big uncertainty. If you look at the uncertainty in how aerosol emissions are going to evolve over the next 30 years, exactly because of this uncertainty in the sort of trajectory of society, they could grow to 20% higher in the next 30 years, or they could fall to nearly zero. And that is coming almost entirely from this uncertainty in what the trajectory of society is going to be.
Okay, and there are proposals to cool the Earth on an emergency basis by injecting sulfate aerosols into the atmosphere on a continuing basis. They call it geoengineering. And one of the key objections raised has been the possibility of unintended consequences, particularly for the cycle of rain and drought. Your research, like the teleconnections map in Figure 2 of the new paper, seems to confirm fears of unintended consequences of geoengineering with sulfates. What are your thoughts, Keita?
I think if we've learned anything through the aerosol research that's happened over the last 10 years, it's that aerosols are an incredibly complex component of the climate system. And as I said, they are not only impacting climate in the place where they're changing. They can also have impacts very far afield. And so given the impact that we have known that these aerosols have had over the industrial era, I think we have a lot of reason to be concerned that we would be able to get exactly the results that we want out of putting these aerosols into the climate system intentionally.
So looking at what we're doing about all this, are there international air pollution conferences as there are for, say, the climate convention?
This is a really important challenge that we have been trying to address in our work in getting the climate community to think more carefully about aerosols. Most of the policy work that's been done around aerosols has happened in the context of air quality and air pollution regulations. So there are large international entities that have focused on sort of transboundary transport of these aerosol pollutants and the ways that that impacts air quality for other places. But those sort of international discussions up until now have not interacted in a very meaningful way with the international bodies that are talking about climate mitigation. And so one of the big goals of the work that we've been doing is to really get out the message that these two communities need to be talking to each other. We are very likely to reduce our aerosol emissions because it's a public health imperative. But if we're not thinking about the impact of those aerosol changes on the trajectory of climate change and climate risk over the next decade and two decades, we're going to be missing a big piece of what is going to be influencing climate risk for specific regions across the world. And that communication needs to be increased.
Keita, you've worked with some of the top research groups in America. What are you working on now?
So we have lots of exciting things in the pipeline. One of the really important projects that we're working on right now is to really quantify the impact of this uncertainty in what aerosol emissions are going to do over the next 30 years for overall climate uncertainty. And so there's a big international consortium of us who are getting together and running a new set of simulations in the global Earth system models that are used to project what will happen with future climate change. And we're building a new set of simulations that's going to let us think about how this uncertainty in whether aerosol emissions are going to increase or decrease in different places, how that's going to impact climate change and climate risk over the next 30 years. So we're hoping with that work to be able to actually get numbers to put in front of decision makers to say, hey, this is a piece of the uncertainty that you're not thinking about that you should be thinking about.
Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I think the big takeaway message is that there is more to climate change even than we are already thinking about. And so learn as much as you can, talk about it as much as you can, and hopefully in the end we will be able to leverage all of this incredible scientific knowledge that we've been generating to chart a hopeful path for all of us.
From the University of Texas at Austin, we have been speaking with the climate and atmosphere scientist Geeta Prasad. You can find links to her open access paper on rapidly evolving aerosol emissions in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Geeta, thank you for clearing up the air on these tough questions.
Thank you, Alex. It was my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.